Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Home Run, Allied Escape and Evasion in World War II, by Howard R. Simpkin. Forward by Lieutenant General Retired Charles Cleveland. Narrated by Dallas Britt. Forward. This book offers an excellent overview of the heroic escapers and evaders of World War II, their escape kit, and the organizations which aided them. The product of 2 years of painstaking research, it is written in a highly understandable, almost conversational style. Having known the author for nearly 40 years, I know that he strives above all else to help others understand with his writing, and I believe that Home Run does just that. It is a soup-to-nuts book which gives the listener a firm grasp of escape by someone who was taken prisoner by the enemy and managed to gain their freedom, and evasion by those who have never been in enemy hands and are seeking to return to friendly control in World War II. As the world again stares at the possibility of global war, Home Run reminds us of an inevitable and dark consequence, while recalling the ingenuity, spirit, and strength of the Allied soldiers and the lengths to which their fellow citizens will go to bring them home. Home Run introduces us to the British and American Allied escape organizations, MI9 and MIZX, respectively. Both provided evaders and escapers with the necessary training and escape kit to make what was commonly referred to as a home run, a return from behind enemy lines. MI9 and MIZX also provided money, agents, and equipment to run escape organizations in occupied areas. These organizations, referred to as lines, provided vital support to evaders and escapers, giving downed Allied aircrew in occupied Europe, Belgium, France, Holland, and Luxembourg as much as a 50% chance of making a home run. Those servicemen unfortunate enough to be taken prisoner faced a different challenge: escape from a prisoner of war camp. Home Run places their trials in context with an examination of camps in the European and Pacific theaters. The descriptions of the Berge and Kabanatuan camps are monuments to the barbarity of two totalitarian systems, which must never be allowed to happen again. The author then takes us on a tour of some of the most successful escape lines, including the Comet Line, brainchild of a 23-year-old Belgian woman nicknamed Didi, which rescued over 800 Allied escapers and evaders, and the Indragiri River Line, set up by the Special Operations Executive to allow British and Commonwealth troops and civilians to escape the fall of Singapore. In its short life from February 13th to March 17th, 1942, it allowed 2,586 military personnel to avoid capture, along with an estimated 4,000 to 7,000 civilians. Successful escapes were made by both small and large groups. We follow Ari Neve and Tony Luton in their perilous flight from the supposedly escape-proof Colditz Castle in Germany to Switzerland, and then across France, Spain, and Gibraltar to safety in England. The author then relates how U.S. Army Air Corps Second Lieutenant Edgar Whitcomb, destined to be Indiana's 43rd governor, made his escape and astonishing 11,000-mile home run by masquerading as a civilian. Despite being repatriated, he then managed to get back into the Pacific War, ending it at Clark Field on Luzon, where he had seen the Japanese attack on December 8, 1941. Prisoners who escaped en masse faced different challenges. The mass escapes detailed in Home Run were from Singapore to Australia and Corregidor to Australia, respectively. The courage and determination of Allied servicemen take center stage in the tale of 18 men in a 36-foot motorboat, led by the intrepid commander, John Morrill, as they made a 31-day, 2,000-mile journey through enemy waters to freedom. Home Run does not forget those unable to escape. The penultimate chapter covers the liberation experience in the European and Pacific theaters. It focuses on three examples: Colditz Castle, Oflag 4C, Mossberg, Stalag 7A, and Kabinetswan. The liberation of Colditz was unique, as the prisoners had already obtained the surrender of the German forces guarding the castle prior to the arrival of any friendly forces. Mossberg was more typical of liberation in Germany, with U.S. tanks and infantry taking control of the camp and freeing the prisoners. Kabinetswan provides the thrilling story of the rescue of 511 emaciated prisoners by Lieutenant Colonel Henry Mucci and the 6th Ranger Battalion. That daring raid is still studied in military academies today. The book concludes with a chapter on the aftermath of the war. It provides some closure on the ultimate fate of many of the people, both prisoner and warder, in the book, and also recounts the uneven justice that was meted out by the victors. The POWs returned home to countries many of them hardly recognized, particularly those captured early in the war, where they were subject to varying treatment by governments that had many other priorities at hand. I would recommend this book to anyone seeking to know about escape and evasion in World War II, whether out of pure interest in history or to glean lessons and considerations in preparation for our next large-scale conventional conflict. Howard Simkin, a retired Green Beret and one of unconventional warfare's best thinkers, has done a masterful job. He has woven a brilliant tapestry from fading and desperate threads on an important but understudied topic. Lieutenant General Retired Charles T. Cleveland, U.S. Army. Chapter 1. Introduction. Imagine that you are deep behind enemy lines during World War II. Your plane was shot down, or perhaps you have just escaped from a prisoner of war camp. The enemy is hunting you, seeking to throw you behind barbed wire for the duration of the war. What will you do? Do you have what it takes to make it to friendly territory? This book tells the story of the brave members of the British Commonwealth and United States Armed Forces during World War II who either evaded capture entirely or were taken prisoner and escaped. During the war, the Germans and Japanese held over 306,000 British Commonwealth and 105,000 U.S. service members as prisoners. But these numbers can only be approximations. The numbers held by the Germans are reasonably solid, as they generally adhere to the reporting requirements of the Geneva Conventions. The Japanese were another matter entirely. Many prisoners of the Japanese were killed before their capture was ever reported, such as those who perished during the Bataan Death March. When deciding which escapes and escape lines to address in detail, I had to be selective. What I sought was to bring stories forward that were either unique or neglected. In doing so, I passed over the considerable accomplishments of the PAT line, which operated for 2 years before being penetrated by the Nazis. The remarkable evasion by survivors of the 1st British Airborne Division in the aftermath of the Market Garden also is omitted. The Dutch Resistance and MI9 managed to mount two operations, Pegasus 1 and 2, to repatriate evading Red Devils from the far side of the Rhine River. The first operation was an unqualified success, with 138 paratroopers crossing the Rhine to freedom. The Germans detected the second, which brought only 7 safely home, with the rest of the evaders being killed, captured, or scattered. This work also does not include the travails of up to 1.8 million French troops captured by the Germans in 1940. Most were sent to camps in Germany and kept on as forced labor. Starting in 1940, the Germans released a trickle of prisoners, mostly reservists, but retained the bulk of the prisoners until they were liberated by advancing Allied forces. After 1942, they repatriated around 100,000 prisoners based on the relief system, where a civilian volunteer took the place of a prisoner. On the whole, the French attitude toward the returning prisoners was not very positive. As a result, there is not the breadth and depth of literature on the subject that there is for British and American troops. Indeed, there is a lack of hard statistics about all aspects of French escapers and evaders. One estimate puts the number of escaped prisoners at around 70,000. How many of those who escaped later joined the resistance or the Free French forces is impossible to say with any accuracy. The number of successful evaders and escapers, both American and British, exceeded 35,000. This book will relate how they fared in enemy hands or managed to remain free. To avoid confusion over terminology, I will refer to those who never fell into enemy hands as evaders, and those who managed to escape from enemy hands and avoid recapture as escapers. This is the same definition used by the Allied escape organizations. The total numbers of escapers and evaders are reflected in the British MI9's end of war report. The following table gives a roll-up of those statistics. Western Europe, American, 3,415. British and Commonwealth, 3,631. India and Southeast Asia, American, 39. British and Commonwealth, 3,346. Switzerland, American, 227. British and Commonwealth, 4,916. Mediterranean West, 3,466 Americans, and 11,910 British and Commonwealth. Mediterranean East, American, 351. British Commonwealth, 4,546. In total, American, 7,498. British Commonwealth, 28,349. For a grand total of 35,847. Of course, not everyone who surrendered was taken prisoner. In the heat of battle, anyone might be shot out of hand because they would slow down their potential captors, or perhaps had fought too well. The German SS were particularly callous in this regard. Allied troops frequently return the compliment when dealing with SS prisoners. Bomber crews downed over Germany after 1943 or over the home islands of Japan at any time were in peril of enraged civilians. Often, their best hope was to fall into the hands of the enemy police or military. Sometimes, racial factors came into play, with black and indigenous troops being treated with particular harshness. This work is about those who either successfully evaded or were taken prisoner and escaped. It will not, therefore, go into detail on these matters. Simply discussing the lives of the evaders and escapers would leave out a significant part of the story. Both the British and the U.S. built escape organizations to aid evaders and escapers in their return to freedom. The British organization MI9 was formed in August of 1939. The American equivalent, MIZX, began operations in 1942. Together, they developed agent networks as well as ingenious means to smuggle escape aids into POW camps. They are a significant part of the story as well. No story of evasion and escape would be complete without paying tribute to the brave men and women who ran escape lines in enemy-occupied territory at great peril to their lives. For example, in its over 2 years of operation, the Comet Line had 156 of its members shot or murdered in Nazi concentration camps. Both the Germans and the Japanese reacted with ferocious cruelty when they discovered escape lines. Imprisonment, torture, and death were certainties for those caught running escape lines or simply aiding evaders. Yet, they carried on their work despite the terror. Heroism, betrayal, sacrifice, and cowardice are all elements of this fascinating portion of the rich tapestry of World War II. This book discusses the essential problems facing Allied evaders and escapers. The most pressing problem was obtaining a few essentials needed by every evader in both theaters of war: food, water, maps, and a compass. In the European theater, papers and appropriate civilian clothing were an added requirement. The ingenuity displayed by the prisoners in obtaining or manufacturing these essentials is astounding. Before proceeding further, it is important to understand that evasion and escape have different but related meanings. Evasion consists of the art and science needed to avoid falling into enemy hands and could take place before or as part of an escape after capture. During World War II, downed airmen were the most frequent pre-capture evaders. Coming down in occupied or enemy territory and playing a high-stakes game of hide-and-seek with enemy forces. Those evaders who succeeded were almost invariably assisted by a resistance network that provided them with food, shelter, false papers, transportation, and guides. Escape was a different matter. The escaper was already in the hands of the enemy. The first problem an escaper had to solve was that of breaking free from captivity. The best time to do so was immediately after capture. The troops guarding the prisoner were not trained for the task, and friendly forces were often in close proximity. The more difficult alternative was to escape from a POW camp deep in enemy territory, staffed by guards who knew their job. Once free, the escaper faced two choices for how to avoid recapture. First, they could choose to find their way to neutral or friendly territory unassisted. Alternatively, they could link up with a resistance network to make their way to freedom. In POW slang, to score a home run. Most of the early escapers did so on their own, because in many countries, the resistance had not coalesced and networks to aid evaders were not yet in place. Later in the war, escapers had a better chance of receiving organized assistance. Evading recapture by the enemy took skill, courage, and an element of luck. However, the evader usually had a very narrow window of opportunity to contact a resistance cell for assistance. Prisoner of war, POW camps, posed their own set of problems for the escaper. As noted earlier, the POW camp guards were trained for their job. The camps were usually constructed to retain prisoners and cut them off from outside aid. However, through the Allied escape organizations such as the British MI9 and American MIS-X, as well as those POW-run organizations which sprung up in most camps, the POW could receive the essential escape aids of food, money, false papers, maps, a compass, and clothing. They were often assisted by their comrades in other essential aspects of their escape. This could range from diversions staged by other prisoners to distract the guards to participation in an escape through a tunnel. From whom did evaders and escapers receive their escape aids? Aircrew, who made up most of the evaders, were issued their escape aids prior to each flight. Prisoners often manufactured escape aids such as false papers, clothing, food, wire cutters, and other tools. There were two external sources of such aids. The first were issued by MI9 beginning in 1941, followed by MIS-X in 1942. Much of the story of how they aided prisoners and evaders was left untold for many years due to security concerns. A particular concern was maintaining the secrecy of the ingenious methods devised to smuggle escape aids into the camps, methods the U.S. and Britain planned to use if the Cold War ever became hot. This work will bring to life the evaders and prisoners who fell into the hands of the Germans and the Japanese in World War II. Most of them have heard taps or last call played over their graves, which makes the task of telling their stories tougher. Fortunately, there is a wealth of information with which to work, including letters, debriefings, oral history, and books written by those who evaded and/or escaped. During World War II, the Japanese and Germans ran hundreds of camps. To make a discussion of camp life comprehensible, I will focus on representative camps in each theater, mentioning other camps as necessary. The camps will include Dulag Luft, Stalag Luft III, and Oflag 4C Colditz, Stalag 9B Bad Orb in Europe and Seoul, Kabanatuan, Amori in Japan, and Chonji, and the Thai-Burma Railway camps in the Asia-Pacific. These chapters will include information on how the Germans and Japanese moved prisoners to and from the camps, along with brief descriptions of the hell ships in the Pacific and the forced marches to avoid the advancing Allied armies in Europe. To put the treatment of POWs by the Germans and Japanese in perspective, it is important to understand the legal framework provided by the 1907 Hague Convention and the 1929 Geneva Convention. The Hague Convention refers to the 1907 Convention 4, respecting the laws and customs of war on land and its annex, regulations concerning the laws and customs of war on land. The Geneva Convention refers to the 1929 Convention relative to the treatment of prisoners of war. When World War II began, all the combatants had ratified the Hague Convention, and all but Japan and the Soviet Union had ratified the Geneva Convention. Interestingly, Japan signed but did not ratify the Geneva Convention. Both conventions expressly forbade the mistreatment of prisoners of war, requiring that they be treated humanely. The 1929 Geneva Convention was an amplification and clarification of the 1907 Hague Convention. As noted by the International Committee of the Red Cross, the most important innovations consisted in the prohibition of reprisals and collective penalties, the organization of prisoners' work, the designation by the prisoners of representatives, and the control exercised by protecting powers. All that can be said about their treatment of POWs is that the Germans violated the conventions less blatantly than the Japanese. For example, the conventions required that POWs be fed on the same scale as the capturing power's armed forces in garrison. The Germans violated this standard by providing around 1,500 calories per day when their garrison ration standard was 2,500 calories throughout 1944. In 1945, that standard declined considerably both for the German armed forces and for their POWs as well. However, the Germans allowed intact Red Cross food parcels through to the camps on an irregular basis, usually at least once every 6 weeks. While the average prisoner lost considerable weight, they were able to keep body and soul together until the Third Reich began to crumble under the hammer blows from the Allies in the West and the Soviets in the East. The Red Cross parcels varied in composition depending on their country of origin. All contained some form of canned meat, crackers, candy, margarine or butter, sugar, powdered or condensed milk, cigarettes, and medicine. Quinine or sulfa drugs were the most common. American parcels almost invariably contained Spam and canned powdered milk referred to as Klim. The cans were almost as highly valued as their contents to use as cookware and escape aids. The signature items for British parcels were bully beef and condendo, a form of condensed milk. A single package could supplement a prisoner's diet for weeks. Attitudes toward prisoners differed greatly between the Germans and the Japanese in general. This was evidenced by the difference in survival rates, with over 96% of Allied prisoners in German hands making it home. Less than 70% of those who were prisoners of the Japanese saw their homelands again. Both statistics have their roots in cultural attitudes and concern for their own prisoners in Allied hands. As in any group, There were those who deviated from the official norm by showing kindness to the prisoners in their charge. However, such acts were the exception, not the rule. Nazi racial theories, together with their rather lame assertion that the Soviet Union had never signed the 1929 Geneva Convention, provided the Germans with their excuse to savagely mistreat Soviet prisoners of war. Of over 6 million Soviet prisoners taken by the Germans, slightly more than 2 million survived, a loss rate of 2/3. The German attitude toward other Allied POWs was less brutal. The Germans were also concerned for their troops who fell into Allied hands. After mid-1943, over 100,000 German troops were already in U.S. and British hands. This was certainly a factor which influenced the Germans to largely observe the Geneva Convention. Another factor was undoubtedly the good treatment of German prisoners of war received in Allied hands. During the war, most were shipped to Canada, and after 1942, the United States as well. Because of the distances involved and the lack of an effective German counterpart to MI9 or MIZ-X, there was but a single German home run. It was scored by a Luftwaffe fighter pilot, Franz von Verha, in January of 1941. He leapt from a moving train as it neared the U.S.-Canadian border. He managed to cross 30 miles of snowy terrain before crossing the St. Lawrence River near Ogdensburg, New York. Since America was neutral at the time, he was handed over to the German consul in New York City, where it appeared that he might be returned to Canada. Verha fled to Mexico. From there, he made his way home to Germany. German culture had a strong bias toward upholding treaties, particularly if Germany benefited from them. As signatories to both The Hague and the Geneva Conventions, the Germans felt a need to observe at least the form of correct behavior, particularly as the Americans and British began to capture more and more German prisoners. The possibility of Allied retaliation against German POWs in the case of mistreatment of Allied POWs acted as a reality check for an increasingly desperate Nazi regime, which contemplated harsh measures against Allied POWs. For that reason, Field Marshal Hermann Göring, who had a genuine concern for captured Luftwaffe personnel, was often a voice for correct treatment of Allied POWs. As Hitler's deputy, his opinion carried considerable weight, although it gradually eroded as the Allied bombing campaign against Germany became increasingly effective beginning in 1943. This attitude of correct treatment was reflected in the camps holding Allied airmen run by the Luftwaffe. That changed in the wake of the Great Escape from Stalag Luft III. This allowed Reichsfuhrer SS Heinrich Himmler to assume overall control of all POW camps, although the guards and administrative staff were still provided by either the Luftwaffe or the Wehrmacht. After that, escaped prisoners were often, but not always, sent to concentration camps, such as Sachsenhausen. Generally, Wehrmacht camps were more strictly administered than those of the Luftwaffe, but brutal treatment of American and British Commonwealth prisoners was the exception, not the rule, in most camps. The glaring exception was Berge, more properly known as Arbeitsdienstlager 650. Co-located with the Berge concentration camp, it was under the control of SS Obersturmbannführer, SS Lieutenant Colonel Willy Hack. For the sake of appearances, Berge was guarded by Wehrmacht troops, but it was under the iron control of the SS. Over 20% of the 350 American POWs who arrived at Berge from Stalag 9B near Bad Orb ultimately perished. They were all supposed to be Jewish, but no more than 80 out of 350 were. According to Hans Kasten, a German-American soldier captured during the Battle of the Bulge, Kasten had been the man of confidence an elected position where a senior enlisted man spoke for the other prisoners.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?